energy with naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise. We have learned from Einstein's theories that matter and energy are one. Physicists believe that all systems in nature have their own particular way of vibrating. From the swing of a pendulum to the waves in the ocean to the light that brightens the sky each day, each of these oscillates at its own unique rate. In the same way, things such as rocks and minerals vibrate very slowly and at speeds that are imperceptible to us. Living things such as plants, animals, and man vibrate faster and appear to be alive. The same holds true for every thought, feeling, event, or word we speak. Each has its own frequency or rate of vibration. What many of us don't realize is if we take everything in our own universe down to its simplest form, it is all just energy. Join Dr. Rita as she explores questions such as, what are we made of? Why do we get sick? How can I live a more balanced and whole life? Call in and talk to her and her thought-provoking guests. Send us your questions and get the help you need to move beyond any obstacles or challenges that may be affecting your life, right from the source. So stay tuned and explore your possibilities.
Hello and happy Friday. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and this is Just Energy Radio. Just Energy Radio is brought to you by SoulHealer.com and the Institute of Applied Energetics, where you can become trained to be an alternative healthcare practitioner. Well, tonight is going to be a very, very, very exciting show. We're going to be talking about a topic that is very close to my heart. So, anyway, everyone is familiar with the idea of the Ark of the Covenant. You know, Moses, burning bush, Ten Commandments, that whole thing. Well, our next guest has developed a theory that says that maybe the story we've heard all our lives might not be the whole truth. So here's a little bit of information about our guest, Frank Joseph. Frank Joseph is the author of a dozen published books about metaphysics, military, interesting combination, and ancient history, which have been released in as many foreign languages. He has been a repeat guest with Shirley MacLaine on her internet radio program. He has appeared on Dreamland with Whitley Strieber, Coast to Coast with Art Bell, and The Jeff Rentz Show, a feature writer for Fate, Command, and Atlantis Rising magazines. His articles about military aviation have been published by the Department of Defense. Joseph's last book, Opening the Ark of the Covenant, is the result of 26 years of research and world travel. So please welcome to the show, Frank Joseph.
Well,
hi, Frank. How are you doing?
Fine, fine. Thank you so much for this wonderful opportunity.
Well, I have to ask you kind of a weird question that has absolutely nothing to do with any of this. Did you used to live in the Bay Area?
No, I never did. Okay. I'm a Midwesterner born and bred.
Okay, just checking.
Okay.
Because this would have been just like one of those really extra weird coincidences.
I used to
live in the Bay Area, and there was this guy, Frank Joseph, who was him and his drum machine, and he'd play in this bar. And, you know, so when I had you scheduled to come on, I kept thinking in the back of my mind, wow, I wonder if this is the same guy.
Sounds like my evil twin.
It's your evil twin.
Yeah, it's my evil twin.
So, Frank, tonight we're really going to take a long, hard look at your new book, Opening the Ark of the Covenant. And I have to tell you, I read it cover to cover, and I have this huge list of questions for you. So I hope you're prepared, have a big glass of water. But before we get into that question part, what led you to even start exploring this topic in the first place?
I did not deliberately start out to investigate the Ark of the Covenant. When I began actually accumulating the information for it, I didn't know what I was doing. I was in a very negative headspace. I was what you call an atheist or an agnostic. And I was mostly interested in ancient civilizations. I wasn't interested in religion or spirituality at all. And as I began to study ancient civilizations, I found that there was a theme that linked these old cultures, regardless of where they were located geographically, whether it was the ancient Maya in the Americas or the ancient Egyptians or the Hindus, there was a single theme that kept repeating over and over again. And that theme was that the basis for the beginnings of these civilizations and the spirituality that they created, the mystical systems of metaphysics they created, centered around a stone. invariably a precious stone. And this stone was supposedly inscribed with great words of wisdom. And a typical example is ancient Egypt, although it's by no means unique. The ancient Egyptians said that their society began long ago in the deep past on an island far out in the Atlantic Ocean, and that this island was a place of great learning. They referred to it as Sekhret Aru, or the Field of Reeds, and that this island began to sink one day, and as it did, a man by the name of Thaut, T-H-A-U-T, led the gods and men away from Sekhret Aru, which means Field of Reeds, before it sank, and they arrived in the Nile Delta, and he carried with him something called the Emerald Tablet. And the Emerald Tablet had described on it words that, if spoken properly, could bring civilization into being. And that when they landed in the Egyptian Delta, Thaut and his followers used the Emerald Tablet to create Egyptian civilization. You find that same story repeated with North American Indians. You find it repeated in China and Tibet, throughout the Pacific. And these are societies that had little or, and for the most part, no physical contact with each other at all. So I began investigating this story of this sacred stone, and that led directly to the Ark of the Covenant.
All right, well, let me ask you this question, because you were talking about the beginning of Egypt, but in your book, you actually start much, much, much further back in time than,
right.
You know, and you actually start your conversation around Lemuria and the mythology in the Pacific Islands, and I just found that really fascinating because, you know, you don't hear a whole lot about Lemuria. And, you know, and can you kind of talk about some of that mythology? Because to me, that's even more the beginning than what happened in Egypt.
Right. I'm just telling you the story of Thaut and the creation of Egyptian civilization is just one of numerous examples, and you can see in that this is mythology. This is a myth, although the Egyptians regarded this story as their founding father, or the story of their founding father. But the origins of this stone go back not only to the beginnings of ancient history, but before, into the era of myth, prehistory it's called. And myth is not a lie. Americans are brought up on that idea. A myth is a way in which a preliterate people preserve those truths that are important to them. And you do that through storytelling and through repeated oral traditions. And the earliest origins that I can find for this stone story are in the Pacific of all places and associated with the Polynesians and the Micronesians. Their story is of a sacred stone which is also carried away from some terrible catastrophe in order for people to rebuild their civilization someplace else. One of the most cogent examples of that is something called the Kanamanishi Stone. The Kanamanishi Stone is known throughout Japanese oral traditions. And the story is that it was a priceless jewel, and that the jewel belonged to a dragon. And the dragon gave up this jewel and went to his kingdom underneath the sea. And the hero who stole this jewel brought it to Japan and created the first human society there, and was enshrined in a temple on the eastern shores of Japan, not far from Tokyo, actually. And the Kanamanishi Stone, which is this great jewel, was used to prevent earthquakes, and it was used to build Japanese civilization. It was misused, however, and the stone was thrown back into the sea. And you can go now to shrines like the shrine outside of Nara, and they have a shrine to the Kanamanishi Stone. It's made just out of granite. It's not the original, because the original was thrown back in the sea. So you follow this throughout the Pacific. In Tibet, they have the Chintamani Stone. It's the same thing. This Chintamani Stone was actually found by Nicholas Rerich in the 20th century, the early part of the 20th century. Nicholas Rerich, across the great mystic painter and explorer. So these stones, it's not just one, but they represent a kind of lost technology, which I believe was able to transform human consciousness. This is not a theory in the sense that I went out to try to prove something, like a theory occurred to me and I tried to find proofs for it. Instead, the theory is an outgrowth of the facts themselves. And that's why in the book I've listed a pretty thick bibliography, because the theory emerges from the evidence. And the evidence indicates that there was a lost civilization, which is remembered as Lemuria to certain cultures. The Romans remembered it as Lemuria, and that the Japanese remembered it as Horai. Went under a many different names, but this lost civilization in the Pacific was the homeland for the technology of this stone. And the stone was carried throughout the world after this society was lost to a series of tsunamis and natural disasters which overwhelmed Lemuria about 10,000 years ago.
So based on your research and information, there isn't any information of a society that predates this Pacific Lemuria society in your knowledge?
There may have been human civilizations before Lemuria, but as far as I was able to determine, no. They went back. I have no idea when Lemuria began, but Lemuria was destroyed 10,000 years ago. Now, that's an incredibly long period, because we're told in our standard textbooks and our universities that human civilization began in Mesopotamia about 3,500 years ago. There was nothing before then. Human beings were a very low-level material culture. But I believe that the evidence conclusively shows that there was a Pacific-wide society, not a continent, but a Pacific-wide society. In other words, the islands and archipelagos of the Pacific were occupied by a highly advanced people known as the Lemurians, who applied this crystal technology, which we are only now beginning to rediscover in places like Silicon Valley. Matter of fact, our whole society is based on crystal technology. Without it, our electronics would not function. I believe that the ancient Lemurians, who were great observers of nature, were able to apply the same technology we've only begun to understand now. But they used their technology much more differently than we do. They used it in order to cooperate with nature, not to master or conquer nature. And by living in harmony, close harmony with nature, they achieved many great things. And they were very different people than ourselves, but I think we have a lot to learn from their legacy, which is preserved. It still exists. And the stone, one of these stones, made it into the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant from the ancient...
Oh, wait, we're gonna get there later.
Okay.
We'll get there later.
Sure.
Don't worry.
All right, I'll follow your lead.
Especially on that topic, because I have a whole series of questions, and I'm like, no, too fast.
Okay.
So Lemuria was first, and then I'm assuming Atlantis came after.
Well, what happened with the Lemurians is that they began to become missionaries for their religion, if you can call it a religion. It's more like a mystical ethic, really, more like Tibetan Buddhism. It's very close to that. I think the Lemurian religion was very close to Tibetan Buddhism. And their missionaries went around the world, and one of the places they went to was a large, beautiful island off the coast of Spain, about 200 miles off the coast of Spain. And there the Lemurians interbred with the local population, and over time, this hybrid people became Atlanteans, and that is the origin of the Atlantean civilization, and they brought with them their technology. The Atlanteans took a slightly different, more than a slightly different, tack from the Lemurians, in that they became more like ourselves. They became more militaristic, more interested in economic considerations than spiritual values, but they still had their crystal technology, and they abused that technology. And as a consequence, they self-destructed themselves.
And after their civilization,
what they did is they used their crystal technology to interface with the very powers of the earth itself in order to achieve greater mining techniques. They were great copper miners. They were the suppliers of copper to the ancient world, and copper in its day, about 5,000 years ago, was the nuclear fission of its time. It was known as the Bronze Age. If you had a corner on the market on copper, you became the wealthiest and most powerful, economically powerful nation on earth, and that's what the Atlanteans were. And after they had abused their legacy from Lemuria and had self-destructed themselves, that technology went to other parts of the world. The crystal technology went to the Canary Islands, went to ancient Egypt, as I described to you. and went to and was picked up by the Hebrew people, as we'll get into. So it became worldwide after the destruction of these two seaborne civilizations. After their catastrophe, the survivors went elsewhere. They took the technology with them. It's the same with us today. We have the technology to build the space shuttle. We don't build just one space shuttle. We build several. And it's the same in the ancient world. They had the technology to craft this crystal, this very powerful crystal. And so they didn't make just one. They made several. And they went to several parts of the world as well.
So one of the things I found interesting was your dating of the fall of Atlantis at 1198 B.C. And how did you come to that conclusion? I mean, you know, you hear Plato's story, and it was, you know, either 9,000 years ago or 900 years ago. I don't know. You know, there are multiple numbers, but where did you come up with that number?
Well, it's not original with me at all. There is a growing general consensus among serious investigators of the Bronze Age and of Atlantis. It's the A word, not allowed to be spoken in polite society and academic society, but nonetheless, the existence of Atlantis is now gaining a lot of credibility, and as such, serious investigators have begin to see that Atlantis was in the context of the Bronze Age. The Bronze Age lasted from 3000 BC to 1200 BC, and the reason why they think so, in a nutshell, is because Plato's description of Atlantis, and it's very detailed, does not fit anything before the Bronze Age. He describes a typical Bronze Age citadel. Now, does this mean that Atlantis only goes back 5,000 years? No. Probably was much older, went back 10,000 or more years ago. But in its final manifestation, it became a Bronze Age civilization and lingered as late as 3,200 years ago. And that is not new with me. That's been discussed and is pretty well understood now by, like I said, serious researchers into this.
It's the first time I've heard that date, so I just kind of found that interesting. So I have kind of a follow-up question to that.
Mm-hmm.
With it being, and I'm going to say so late in prehistoric or, you know, B.C. times, how come civilizations like the Egyptians and the Mesopotamians and the Minoans, you know, you would think that there would be more information, more documentation through their traditions and their stories of trades with this group?
Well, you would think so, except that you have to understand that something happened after the destruction of Atlantis, which was 1200 B.C., generally speaking. What ensued was a dark age. This is understood and acknowledged by even mainstream historians that between 1200 B.C. and about 700 B.C., the world went through a period of a complete collapse. There was no more literature, no more written languages. The population of the world precipitously declined. Civilization almost went out. There was virtually no civilized society between 1200 BC and 700 BC. All the established civilizations like Egypt were in steep decline, were shattered, and it took 5 centuries before human beings began to reclaim the basis for civilization. We had the same thing happen with the fall of the Roman world. We went into a dark age, and all of the high science, all of the great art that had been produced for hundreds of years before was either forgotten, destroyed, and it took the Renaissance hundreds of years to piece things back together. We're still trying to piece things back together, what they did back then. And the same thing happened after the destruction of Atlantis, so all the records were mostly lost. You have mostly traditions. And it's that dark age that ensued, which is understood and acknowledged as a real fact. That is the reason why we don't have as much information as we would like to have. But believe me, there is a huge amount of material that has survived, not just traditions, actual hard record evidence, which shows that Atlantis not only existed, but existed in the place and in the time that we say it did.
Okay, so I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but can you...
Oh, please do. I'm used to it.
Oh, okay. I mean, this is like, you know... I wanted to be an archaeologist when I was a kid, so this is like one of my favorite topics. So,
okay.
So can you give an example of where some of this documentation would be? You know, is it in Egyptian, you know, monuments or, you know, documentation, or Where would it be? Because I just, you don't hear about it.
No, you don't hear about it. And the reason why you don't hear about it is because the archaeologists and the professors have a stranglehold on this information. They don't want it out. That's a whole other show, though. But I will tell you a wonderful place where you can visit. You can go there today and see it. It's a place called Medinet Habu, M-E-D-I-N-E-T-H-A-B-U, which is in the lower Nile. It's outside of Luxor. And it is the largest and best preserved of all of the major temple complexes to survive the New Kingdom. It was built by the Pharaoh Ramses III around 1187 BC. This is just when the Dark Ages began. And Egypt held out for a little while. And on the walls of Medinet Habu, which are remarkably well preserved, even some of the original paint and color is still there, is the entire story of the Atlantean War, of how the Atlanteans invaded the Nile Delta, and how Ramses III's forces fought this enormous incursion. We're talking about a major invasion. 20,000 elite marine troops overwhelmed the Nile Delta and pushed back all of his forces. They were allied with Libyans and Palestinians and people from the Sudan. Nabataeans, we refer to them as Numidians. It was an enormous four-pronged invasion, very serious. Egypt came close to being defeated, and it was only through the military genius and the courage of Ramses III that he saved his country. And he has the whole story still preserved on the walls of Medinet Habu. And on those walls, they're known as the Medinet Habu texts. Anybody that doesn't believe me in any of this, then just Google all this. It's all, the information is all out there. It just isn't talked about. It isn't discussed because it's not politically correct. And on the walls of Medinet Habu, Ramses III commissioned his scribes to tell the story of this enormous campaign in which he was the victor. And to cut to the chase on this and what you're referring to, he has his scribes interrogate the captured and marines that invaded his country. And the Egyptians refer to these enemies as the Meshwesh, or sometimes referred to as the Habaru, mostly Meshwesh, which means sea peoples. And they say, where did you come from? All the interrogation is on the walls. They ask the Meshwesh where they came from. They say they came from beyond the 12th bow. That means they came from the Atlantic Ocean, because the Egyptians had maps in which they used semicircles to define certain sections of geography. And these semicircles were referred to as bows. The 12th bow would correspond to the Straits of Gibraltar. So they came from beyond the 12th bow, which means the Atlantic Ocean. And they said, well, why did you invade Egypt? We have never invaded you. We don't even know where you are. You're so far away. And the Meshwesh responded by saying that our sacred island, referred to as Netaru, which means the sacred island, our sacred island in the Atlantic Ocean was set on fire by a comet, and that the island, after having been set on fire, plunged beneath the sea. We survived. We had no place else to go. We still had a military power, and so we gambled all by attacking you in the hopes that we would achieve conquest. That's all on the walls of Medinet Habu, in addition to actual profiles from life of the captured Meshwesh, the captured Atlanteans. And it shows a non-Egyptian people with rather aquiline features, horsehair helmets similar to Romans, and also their battleships. Yes?
Well, that's the music, which means we need to go to a break, Frank.
Okay.
I'm Dr. Rita Louise. This is Just Energy, and we'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
Hi, I'm Dr. Rita Louise, the host of Just Energy Radio and the founder of the Institute of Applied Energetics. Start a new career today on the leading edge of alternative health and healing. The Institute of Applied Energetics can help you develop the specialized skills you need to work as an energy medicine practitioner, intuitive counselor, or professional medical intuitive. Besides our outstanding technical instruction, our programs also support you in creating and building a successful business in this rapidly growing field. Be a catalyst for changing the way healthcare is done around the world. Contact the Institute of Applied Energetics right away or visit AppliedEnergeticsInstitute.com. You can get a copy of Dr. Rita's latest book, Avoiding the Cosmic 2x4, by visiting www.soulhealer.com. Get your copy today.
Are you involved in a new relationship that seems too good to be true? You know, there is an easy way to find out who you're dealing with. For over a decade, AmericaFind has provided its customers with information to make faster, safer, and smarter relationship decisions. Their background check service is a quick and inexpensive way to feel more secure about all your personal and professional relationships. AmericaFind will empower you with all the resources you need to check an individual's background and credibility. So before you say, I do, or hire a new babysitter or nanny, call AmericaFind. Know what you're getting into before you invest your heart, your money, or your time. Call us toll-free at 888-256-2155, and in less than 30 minutes, we'll give you peace of mind. Let AmericaFind tell you the truth.
Move past the crossroads in your life and discover alternative solutions to your deepest concerns at soulhealer.com. So whether it's a physical problem, an emotional issue, a question about work, or troubles in your relationships, naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise can help you. Bring peace, harmony, and health back into your life. Schedule a session today. Visit soulhealer.com right away and live the life you've been dreaming of.
The International Association of Medical Intuitives is an organization dedicated to connecting you with professional medical intuitives from around the world. So if you're feeling ill and under the weather or are looking to join a professional organization such as this, visit www.medicalintuitives.net. That's www.medical-intuitives.net.
Back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and we're talking tonight to Frank Joseph, the author of Opening the Ark of the Covenant. And if you have a question for Frank, please give us a call at 888-863-2722. We'd love to hear from you. Frank, this has been so interesting, and I think it's just sad that, you know, Egyptologists or, you know, archaeologists or society in general doesn't want to put this information out for people to find out what the truth is.
Well, that's what makes people like yourself so important, is you're bringing out things that otherwise are not accessible to people. And that's why I think we have a role to play, that the establishment is not going to discuss these things.
So let's keep on moving. So in your book, you talk a lot about the pyramids, and can you describe what they were built for?
Well, the Great Pyramid is the most important of them all, but most people are not aware that it is really only one of about 100. There are about 100 pyramids in ancient Egypt, and they are all located on either side of the Nile River, on the east and the west. They look almost from space like a great zipper. And it's interesting is that the Nile Valley, the Nile River itself, runs through a major earthquake fault zone. Now, that area of the world is earthquake prone. It's also one of the most rich areas in the world agriculturally. So if you want to settle in a place like that, you're going to have a wonderful agricultural life, but you're going to be beset by major seismic activity that'll make building rather difficult. Now, I'm cutting to the chase here, of course, and the book is 150,000 words long, so I'm really summarizing. But what I'm saying is that after the destruction of Atlantis, and even before, when there were major waves of immigration from this high society, many Atlanteans settled before this great battle that I told you about when relations with Egypt deteriorated, but many Atlanteans migrated to the Nile Valley because their own homeland was beset by major problems. When they moved into the Nile Valley, they found that they had to have some way to ameliorate the worst effects of earthquakes. Now, how could you possibly do that? Who can control earthquakes? They had the technology that could do that. It's a technology which mainstream scientists are totally unable to accept because supposedly nothing like that existed then. Yet we are at a time when our technology is able to at least appreciate what they did. And what they did was this. They created not just one great pyramid, but like I say, about 100. And each one of these pyramids, if you go inside them, and I've been inside several, been lucky enough to go to Egypt several times, is that they are the most un-Egyptian of all of the monuments in Egypt. Because every other temple that you can find throughout ancient Egypt is covered with decorations, is covered with statues, makes way for statues and hieroglyphs. You go inside the pyramids, there are no hieroglyphs. There are no paintings. There are no statues or provisions for statues. What are we looking at here? The Great Pyramid, if you make a cross-section of it, you can see a cross-section of it in almost every standard text on ancient Egypt. And what does it compare to? It compares to nothing known whatsoever, with its very small chambers, its very narrow corridors. If you were inside the Great Pyramid, you stuffed 200 people in there. That's about all you could fit inside the Great Pyramid. And yet this building is immense. Its original height was 481 feet high. It was the highest building in the world until the Eiffel Tower was made in the 19th century. It's an immense structure. It's so complex it could not be rebuilt today. The fellow, his name was Harris, who made the Mall of America in Minneapolis. And when he was asked how the Great Pyramid was made, he said, "I don't have a clue, and there's no way I could rebuild it, even with the machinery we have today." This is the fellow that built the Mall of America. So we're looking at a technology which is fabulous. The interior, this cross-section that I refer to, the Great Pyramid, does, however, resemble one thing very closely, and that is a transducer. A transducer is a device, an instrument that was made in the middle 19th century, and the transducer takes one form of energy and transforms it into another form of energy. A transducer would be like the old needle in a photograph or the arm of a phonograph. It used to sit on top of a record, and the needle would pick up the mechanical vibrations and the grooves of the record, and then would transmit these grooves into a little crystal. And the crystal then would transform those mechanical waves into electrical waves. And then the electrical waves would be fed into your loudspeaker. That's basically how a phonograph works. And that is exactly what the Great Pyramid was and is. It is a geotransducer. It is a machine. It is a device, an instrument, which was made specifically to transmute the mechanical stress of tectonic energy into electrical energy, to disperse it into electrical energy. I know this is a fantastic thing to say, but if you compare the interior of the Great Pyramid with a transducer, you will see that it is a template match. And that's the reason why these things were built. In order for them to work, however, you have to have a very superbly crafted crystal. And that is the emerald tablet that Thout talked about. He brought from his former homeland, Sekhmet Aru, we can call it Atlantis, it went under various names as it was known to various peoples, and that this emerald tablet was not a tablet, and that wasn't even an emerald. These are poetic allusions to a great crystal, which was placed inside the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid, and was its most valuable component part in a geotransducer. And that is what the Great Pyramid was and is. I know I've summarized it very briefly. It's very difficult to believe, but hopefully I've been able to discuss it at length in the book in a little bit more convincing way.
No, that was great. I think you did a very good job at putting it all in a nice little nutshell. Now I have a question about that. You know, you, as you said, there are like 100 other pyramids in the Nile Valley, you know, including, you know, the other Great Pyramid and the Red Pyramid and the Ben Pyramid and, you know, all of these other pyramids. And I'm assuming that you're including the ones that are in Nubia as part of this number?
I don't include the ones in Nubia. Ones in Nubia were built as tombs. They were built much later. They were built literally thousands of years after these other the Great Pyramids were built. The ones in Nubia were copied. By the time they were made, which was they were made only like about 2,000 or less years ago. The reason why was because by that time, people had totally forgotten what the Great Pyramid and its fellows were used for. People assumed that they were used just as tombs. And so the Nubians built smaller versions of tombs and copying what they thought was royal funeral architecture.
Got it. So, and correct me if I'm wrong, so did each of the non-Nubian pyramids also have a crystal inside of them to make them work correctly?
I believe they did. Now, I have not been in all of those 100 pyramids. I've been in several others, and they all have provision for crystals. The Great Pyramid had the Great Crystal, though. This was the most powerful one. The Great Pyramid is unique from all of the other 99 or whatever. I don't think anyone's ever been able to tally up exactly how many pyramids the ancient Egyptians had because some of them are in terribly ruinous condition. They're just foundations left. But the general consensus is 99 or 100. But the Great Pyramid differs from all the rest of them because of its incredible geodetic qualities. Its location at the absolute center of the world's landmass. It's just an unbelievable amount of information that just plays directly in it. Yes, though, to answer your question, I speculate that there were crystals in the other pyramids because they also have the same configuration as the Great Pyramid in that they have a central chamber, and in the central chamber, it's usually set off-center, invariably set off-center, just as in a transducer, there is provision for a coffer or a sarcophagus, as the archaeologists refer to it. And this sarcophagus is almost invariably made of some crystalline material like granite, and it is large enough to include crystal that served as the capacitor. That's really what the crystal would work as. In the record player that I told you about, the phonograph, that little crystal is referred to as a capacitor. A capacitor is a little crystal device which sucks in one form of energy, stores it, accumulates it, magnifies it, and then discharges it. And that is exactly what the crystal did inside the Great Pyramid and in the other pyramids as well. So if you were to go back to ancient Egypt, you were there during a time of tectonic stress or earthquake activity, you would see these structures smoking, some of them, great beams of light, electrical discharge going out the tops of these structures, and the earthquake would still take place, but it would be moderate. It wouldn't be as catastrophic as it would be without the presence of those geotransducers.
And so are there some stories that revolve around that emanation of light and energy around the pyramids?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the stone itself, after the emerald tablet had been removed and placed inside the Great Pyramid, it was referred to as the Stone of Light or the Fire Stone. Mostly it was referred to as the Benben Stone. Benben in ancient Egyptian means fire or energy stone. It was also referred to as the Bennu Stone, B-E-N-N-U, which means the Phoenix Stone. The Phoenix, of course, was a mythical bird which arose out of its own ashes every 144,000 years. The Stone of Destiny. Wherever the stone goes, it's almost invariably referred to as a firestone. Before it went to Egypt, it was in the Canary Islands, which are about 80 miles off the coast of North Africa, and there it's referred to also as the firestone. You find this theme almost wherever you go, referring to this positive crystal. As far as the Great Pyramid acting like a transducer, that's an excellent question. What traditions are there? There's a wonderful, very modern tradition. Actually, it's not a tradition. It's an eyewitness. I was contacted about 12 years ago by a fellow who had visited the Great Pyramid, as a tourist. And one evening he wanted to see the Great Pyramid one last time, and he was out standing out at his hotel looking towards the Great Pyramid at about 3 o'clock in the morning when the top began to glow with this blue light. He thought he was nuts or hallucinating. And he talked to other people about it, and apparently that was a phenomena which is still seen occasionally, this blue mist or haze, this incandescent maze which plays over the top of the Great Pyramid. Scientists refused to believe that such a thing existed until it was photographed, I guess, only about 7 years ago, and so now they know that it does exist, it does happen. Now, interestingly
and so
enough...
Even without the crystal and without the gold that was up on the top, it still kind of works.
It still kind of functions. Now, because it's this blue haze, it's not focused anymore. It sort of wanders around the top. It looks like a mystical, ghostly sort of a luminescence. But exactly, you're right. The top 30 feet of the Great Pyramid are missing. It's not that there was a capstone up there. A capstone that would have been 30 feet high would have weighed so much it would have deformed the entire structure. Instead, they had a 30-foot-high room or chamber at the top, which was sheeted in gold, and that is Arabic tradition. The Arabs talk about that, and some of the old Egyptian painted references to the Great Pyramid show it with a gold cap, a gold top. That's a perfect conductor. That's what a conductor needs. Needs to be placed on top of a transducer. They're not always gold, although sometimes they are made out of gold, because gold is an excellent metal for conducting and focusing the electrical discharge. And the blue haze is something we refer to as the Andes glow. It's a natural thing that happens if there's a mountain that happens to be over an earthquake zone, and the mountain happens to have a lot of quartz or crystal in it, a lot of granite, and a lot of course mountains do have that, especially in the Andes, and this blue glow, this blue haze is seen and been photographed. It takes place also in Japan. It's referred to by different names over there. Sometimes it's red, but mostly this blue color occurs, and that blue color is generated by the forces that are being transmuted from this great stress in the earth into electrical energy, and that is done by way of the crystal that happens to be in the granite in the mountain, and it used to be working in the Great Pyramid before it was deactivated, but it still works a little bit.
And you know, when you talk about that crystal energy, you know, I mean, I guess like quartz watches work kind of by that same principle where the quartz crystal is being compressed and it sets off an electrical charge which keeps your watch going.
That's known as piezoelectricity, and it goes all the way back to the very first radio sets. They were known in the 1920s as crystal sets, and they worked by turning this knob. And when you turn this knob, it was really a little vise inside the radio, and the vise would tighten on a crystal. And when the crystal is tightened enough, in other words, subjected to mechanical stress, physical stress, it shoots out a little electrical spark, and that would turn the radio on. It's called jumping the spark. It's the same thing like you're walking across a carpet, for example, a plush carpet, and you happen to reach for a brass doorknob, and this little electrical shock shock jumps from your finger. Same principle.
Okay. But there's the music, which means we need to go to break again. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. This is Just Energy Radio. We're talking to Frank Joseph, the author of Opening the Ark of the Covenant, and we'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
Stuck and unsure which way to turn on your path? Do you lack focus and direction in life? Do you feel something is missing? So what do you want? A better job? Your dream home? More money? Your ideal mate? Dakara has practical tools to assist you. Schedule a session today to get clear about what you truly desire to deliberately create the life you want. For more information, visit ManifestingConsultant.com or call toll-free 1-800-813-3877.
Start the year off right by visiting livinggrocery.com. Experience the miracle of real nutrition as it helps you to lose weight and improve your overall health. Don't mess with pills or capsules. We provide the highest quality, all-natural organic foods that come ready to eat. And best of all, it's delivered straight to your door. Visit livinggrocery.com now and experience your own amazing transformation. Hi, I'm Dr. Rita Louise, the host of Just Energy Radio. There's no greater blessing in the world than your good health. Science is now showing that simply eating a high-quality diet doesn't provide us with all the nutrition we need. Doctors recommend we supplement our diets with products derived from whole food concentrates. And one of the most complete and nutritious whole foods found on the earth are little microscopic plants called marine phytoplankton, which can be found in a product called Frequency. I've been taking Frequency every day for about 6 months now, and I feel more energized and full of life. If you're ready to make a difference in your health, I encourage you to try Frequency and see what it can do for you. To learn more about Frequency and other amazing whole food natural products direct from Mother Nature, please visit productsforthesoul.com.
You want to host your own radio talk show? You provide the voice and the content. We do all the rest. www.innerstreamsradio.com for more information.
Are you in the middle of a messy divorce? Do you think your spouse is trying to hide money, possessions, or property from you? Call America Fine today. America Fine will give you an accurate picture of your spouse's assets. We can help you locate any hidden bank accounts, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, or safety deposit boxes that have been concealed from you in the courts. The reality is, the court can only divide what it knows exists. Be smart and take control of your future. Make sure everything is put on the table before you step into the courtroom. Just call us today, toll free at 888-256-2155. And in less than 24 hours, we'll give you peace of mind. Let America Fine help you get the fair judgment you deserve.
Hi, I'm James Othayanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio. Listen to Dr. Rita's Soul Healer Moment live each third Sunday night of the month on Feet to the Fire. www.feettofire.com for more information. And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and we're talking to Frank Joseph, the author of Opening the Ark of the Covenant. This has just been very, very interesting. So, Frank, okay, we were talking about that there were, you know, like 100 different pyramids in Egypt. Is there any special significance to the Gaza Plateau by itself, you know, where there's the three big pyramids and even the Sphinx there as well?
Well, there's a lot of great significance there, and I think one of the most chilling pieces of information that came out in this is that the name for the site, it's called the Giza Plateau. Well, that's Arabic, of course. I don't know what it means, just Arabic for that plateau. Now, the Egyptians referred to that plateau by a different name. They referred to it as the place or the plateau of the Tuwai. And that name, Tuwai, is rather ambiguous. It may refer either to the Great Pyramid, or it may refer to the three pyramids together, the complex, or it may refer to something inside the Great Pyramid, like that stone. But that is the name that Egyptologists know how the Egyptians refer to that area. It's called the place of the Tuwai. They're not sure exactly what it refers to. Now, Edgar Cayce, the great psychic of the 20th century, the sleeping prophet, had many readings on Atlantis, including readings on this great crystal that the Atlanteans had. And he referred to that crystal, and he did not know, I have to say this parenthetically, Edgar Cayce was a brilliant but an uneducated man from Kentucky. He had no real educational background, certainly didn't know about any of the mainstream ideas of his day. But Edgar Cayce referred to this stone that was in Atlantis, the great mighty crystal, he referred to it as the Tuwai stone. I think that's remarkable that a psychic in the 1920s and 30s would refer to that Atlantean word. He says it was an Atlantean word, the Tuwai stone. And here the Egyptians referred to the place where the Great Pyramid was featured as the place of the Tuwai. Interesting.
Well, you know, yeah, but speaking of Edgar Cayce, you know, one of his predictions was that the depository of wisdom would be located under this, the paw of the Sphinx. And there was something that I thought was interesting in your book. You had made a statement that said Arab sources stated that the pyramids were built to prevent ancient wisdom from being lost. And do you think that there's a correlation between those two statements?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt that Edgar Cayce was one of these people whose subconscious mind transcended any of our temporal understandings of the universe, and he came back with valuable information. To give you an example of what you're talking about, Edgar Cayce said that underneath the paw of the Sphinx, I think it's the right paw, he said. Underneath the right paw of the Great Sphinx is a hall of records that would contain all this information and some things we're talking about here tonight. And he mentioned this back in the 1920s, I think. And as recently as the mid-1990s, there was a group that took soundings by the Great Sphinx by the paw, and they found that underneath the left paw, Cayce may have been off on his left and his right, but underneath the left paw of the Great Sphinx, sure enough, there is a subterranean chamber that archaeologists and Egyptologists knew nothing about whatsoever, and that it appears to go down straight like it is definitely a man-made pit, goes down maybe about 50 feet, makes a sharp right turn and goes on, they don't know how far, into a kind of a corridor. Now, when these soundings were made, you do it by taking a metal plate and you hit it with a sledgehammer on the ground, and then you have a listening device, a sort of a sonar device, which follows the shock wave down, and therefore they're able to measure it. Well, when the Egyptian authorities saw this, they said, you can't do this anymore because you're going to cause structural damage to the monument. And so no further research has been done there, has been allowed to be done, but which is unfortunate. But there's no doubt that Cayce was right, if not underneath the correct paw. It certainly is under one of the two paws of the Great Sphinx that there is definitely a man-made chamber down there, just as he said.
Well, you know, I think that's another one of those things that are a little bit on the hush-hush.
It's on the hush-hush, too, but I can understand how the Egyptian authorities would worry about somebody banging away with a sledgehammer by this monument, which is at least 4,000 years old. Until they find some less potentially destructive device to do it, I can understand why they would be reluctant to allow that to proceed.
There's this part of me that believes that they've already found it and they've already been in it and they just don't want to share it. But that's just between me and you.
Well, I think you probably are more right than you know.
You know, one of the things that I wanted to ask, you know, most people think that the pyramid is just like a bunch of blocks stacked on top of each other to make this structure. But according to you, there's actually different courses and different kinds of materials, or maybe not different kinds of materials, but it's put together in different ways to create this thing. You know, it was getting a little technical for me there, but...
transducer. It's a geotransducer.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, the people that think it's just as a pile of stone should just go there and see it. It's an incredibly complex construction. The only way that it could have been made, it's pretty well understood how at least the first three quarters of it were made relatively easily. How did they lift these stones, you know, and so on? Well, the Egyptians were great irrigationists. Even the most hog-tied conventional Egyptologist will agree with that. And so I postulate in my book, I don't insist on it, but I think that the way that the Egyptians built at least the first three quarters of the Great Pyramid, where they floated these stones down the Nile and they created sluice gates and coffer dams and were able to raise the stones into the air to a certain extent by artificially raising the water level, which they were able to do. And I think that's how they floated them into place. However, that doesn't explain how they built the roof of the King's Chamber. The roof of the King's Chamber contains a set of, six stones, which are set at an angle, like pitched like a roof, directly over the King's Chamber, and each one of those stones weighs about 70 tons. They are set with the same precision as a watchsmith's, exactitude. And 70 tons, give you an idea how much that weighs, that's about as much as a diesel locomotive. And the the construction genius that went into that just defies anything that's known today. So the Great Pyramid is a great monument, great physical proof to a high civilization that was once there.
Perfect timing. It's the music, which means we need to go to a break. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. We're talking to Frank Joseph, author of Opening the Ark of the Covenant, and we'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages. Are you getting your greens? Now you can have your greens and drink them too with Inner Food by Inner Health Botanicals. Inner Food promotes health and boosts energy with nature's finest superfoods. Inner Food is 70% organic and 100% natural without fillers and is a whole food product totally assimilated by the body. Inner Food is spirulina, chlorella, dulse, kelp, spinach, alfalfa, barley, wheatgrass, rosehip, beetroot, and much more in real amounts, not just a sprinkle to fill out an inflated but impotent list of ingredients. Just mix a tablespoon in your protein shake or in your favorite fruit juice and you are good to go and go and go. Other greens on the shelf typically weigh 300 grams and sell for between $35 and $70. Inner Food is a full 400 grams, 33% more, for $39.95 plus shipping. Simply go to our website, innerstreamsradio.com, and click on any Inner Health Botanical banner and you're ready to order. Or call 866-762-9238 and be sure to mention you heard them on Inner Streams Radio. Inner Food, building health from the inside out. Most people think of addictions relating to drugs, alcohol, and tobacco. However, obsessive compulsive actions taken to excessive levels have the same biochemical goal. They stimulate the creation of natural feel-good hormones, but at a cost that causes more harm in the long run. And prescribed drugs are often many times more dangerous and addictive than the symptoms they aim to treat. AddictionSupplements.com have proven supplements that supply the brain with the nutrients it needs to naturally rebalance the biochemical system, which is the real cure for the real cause. AddictionSupplements.com has cutting-edge supplements designed by real science and real doctors, such as Dr. Charles Gant, MD. Interested in turning your life around? Point your browser to AddictionSupplements.com.
Hello, how can I confuse the hell out of you with complex rate offers and rip you off for some more money?
Huh? I was calling to see how I could save money.
Get real. This is a corporation whose sole purpose is to make money on you, not save money for you.
Some phone companies bury their profits in complex savings plans. Others charge you flat rates for unlimited calls and then bank on you using less minutes, which ends up increasing your real price per minute cost. And if you use more minutes than they deem customary, you may be moved up to a higher rate. The solution is Invincible Phone Cards. From our website, you simply enter where you're calling from and where you're calling to. In seconds, there's a comprehensive, easy-to-read comparative chart empowering you to choose your real savings. You pay what you see, and you see what you save. In minutes after payments, you get your toll-free access and PIN numbers in your email. www.invphone.com. Invincible Phone Savings with Invincible Phone Cards. invphone.com.
70 million Americans suffer from sleep deficit. I'm James Afayanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio, and I'd like to tell you about Earth Pulse Magnetic Field Supplementation. While using the Earth Pulse device, I found that I drifted off to sleep faster, I slept deeper, and I woke up more refreshed, and it does much, much more. Call them right now at 888-211-7888, or check out their website at www.earthpulse.net.
But wait, there's more. When you buy a new digitally programmed Earth Pulse version 4 magnetic supplementation device and use the special Feet to the Fire coupon code F2F, you'll receive an instant $50 savings. No rebates to get lost in the mail. Just $50 more in your pocket on your way to better health.
888-211-7888 or check out their website at earthpulse.net and use the special Feet to the Fire coupon code F2F. Earth Pulse. Deeper, more restful sleep, or your money back.
You want to host your own radio talk show? You provide the voice and the content. We do all the rest. www.innerstreamsradio.com for more information.
Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise. What am I made of? Why do I get sick? How can I live a more balanced and whole life? These are just a few of the questions that will be explored tonight by your host, naturopath, medical intuitive, and clairvoyant Dr. Rita Louise. Call in and talk to Dr. Rita and her thought-provoking guests. Get the help you need to move beyond any obstacle or challenges affecting your life right from the source. And now back to Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise.
Hi, and welcome back to the second hour of Just Energy Radio. Just Energy Radio is brought to you by SoulHealer.com and the Institute of Applied Energetics. Tonight, we are talking to Frank Joseph, the author of Opening the Ark of the Covenant, which this has been a, just an interesting conversation. And if you'd like to call in and talk to Frank, get your questions answered, please call us at 888-863-2722, or you can drop us an email at justenergyradio@yahoo.com. So, Frank, now we're getting to the juicy part, at least to me, juicy part. So let's talk about the Jews in Egypt. So there's kind of, it's kind of a two-part thing that I want to break up. First was how the Jews ended up in Egypt in the first place. That's part one. And then part two, how did they get out of Egypt? So here's my question. There was a TV special called Exodus Decoded, and it was believed by those writers that the Exodus was facilitated by the eruption of Santorini, which led to the Hyksos, you know, I have no phonic skills, expulsion. And so basically what they said was that when Santorini exploded, it caused, you know, fragments of the volcano to go into the water, which turned the water red, and then parts of the volcano flew into Egypt, and that was where it was like, hailing stones of fire, you know, and it was actually a pretty compelling argument. Timeline was kind of messed up, but it was pretty compelling. What do you think of their theory?
I've come to the same conclusion independently. I think that you cannot separate that enormous event that took place from the Exodus. The enormous event that I'm talking about is just that you mentioned the eruption of Thera. When this island exploded in the year 1628 B.C., now they've got that date nailed down really well. In 1628 B.C., the island of Thera exploded with the force of, I guess, about 150 mega-atomic bombs, and it created an enormous tsunami and fabulous destruction throughout the entire eastern Mediterranean. It was at this time that the Semitic people who lived in the Levant, what is today Palestine, had to leave, not only because of the tsunamis so much, but because their agriculture had been absolutely decimated. The effects of this tremendous explosion, the super atomic explosion, were to completely alter destroy the economic base of the Near East. And so these people fled en masse from Palestine and were allowed to settle as refugees in the eastern delta by the Egyptian authorities, the Nile Delta. And that is the origin of the Jewish migration into Egypt. They didn't go there because they wanted to take over or they were invaders. They were refugees from this catastrophe.
Well, see, but that's the thing. According to this show, okay, and not meaning to be confrontational or anything, but according to this show, that is why they left Egypt, was because it exploded and it created the 10 plagues, which gave them the opportunity to get out of Egypt, not come into Egypt.
Right. No, the argument or the debate, whatever you want, the discussion, I suppose, it hasn't reached a level of a bit, but the discussion on this is whether the effects that were created by Santorini, the explosion of the island of Thera. Santorini is its modern name. It was known as Thera in ancient times while this was going on. It was a volcanic mountain. It exploded, sank into the sea. The only question is of dating and associating either the comings or the goings of the Jewish people with this event. It seems clear now that I don't know how recently that TV show you saw was made, but it seems
A little over a year ago.
Okay, well, it's only been really about a year or so that geologists have been able to date the destruction of Thera to 1628 BC. Now, if in fact it did take place in 1628 BC, and it appears that it did, that's way too early for the Jews to have left Egypt. We know that there were settled large Jewish communities in Egypt well after that period. So it is now pretty well understood that event was the catalyst for them moving into Egypt and not leaving. Now the reason why they left was not for geologic reasons. That was for military reasons.
Military?
Yes. This invasion that I told you about that is very well documented, that is accepted by Egyptologists and historians, when the Meshwesh, or the Sea Peoples, we can call them Atlanteans, invaded Egypt and almost occupied Egypt, almost overthrew Egypt. And Egypt was at its height at this time. We're talking about a very the superpower of its day. This is around 1240 B.C., around that time, when the Egyptian authorities were in fact driven from the Nile Delta. The Nile, it'd be the same thing as if somebody invaded the United States and threw the government out of Washington, D.C. That's basically what happened. And the president had to fight to organize a country from, say, Denver or something. The same
no
thing
comment
happened.
On that one.
Yeah. No, well, I just try to make a parallel so listeners can understand. And when this happened, the Jewish community was led by a renegade vizier. Now, a vizier would be like the vice president. It'd be like, let's say that this invasion took place and President Bush ran off to Denver and Cheney stayed behind in Washington and took over and made common cause with the enemy. And that's exactly what happened with the pharaoh. His name was Merimtah. And when Merimtah's second in command, his name was Ramoza, when Ramoza stayed behind, he turned against his own pharaoh. He turned against the Egyptians and made common cause with the invading sea peoples. And this is a historical character. This is not somebody that's made up. It's not a fictional thing. And so he organized not only the Jewish people, but most of the people that were discontent with Egyptian rule. And he created his own state, or tried to, very briefly, under the mistaken belief that the Meshwesh, the sea people, were there to stay and that the Egyptians were on their way to getting beat forever. When, as it turned out, Pharaoh Merimtah turned the tables on the sea peoples and threw them out and was able to regain control of his own country. Nobody thought that would be possible. And so Ramoza is in a lot of trouble. He and his people, his followers, they had done some terrible atrocities when the Egyptians had been thrown out. They had looted the temples. They had disbanded the Egyptian religion and instituted their own monotheism. Had taken over the civil authority. They had driven off the guards of the Great Temple. The guards of the Great Temple were known as the Rostau, or the Watchers, and they were either massacred or driven away, probably a combination of both. And the worst thing of all, perhaps even worse than these things, or at least as bad anyway, is that Ramoza and three other men entered the Great Pyramid and they stole the Benben stone. They stole the crystal, the stone of destiny, the fire stone. They took it out of there. And so, for their own purposes, and then when Merimtah came back and reconquered the Nile Delta, Ramoza and his people felt it was probably wise to leave as quickly as possible. And this is the basis for the Exodus. When Ramoza is leading his people then out into the wilderness, he throws off all of his Egyptian pretenses, and they refer to him not as Ramoza anymore, but as Moses. And that's the real Moses. The real Moses was this Egyptian vizier who had tried to usurp power in the Nile Delta, and found that it was advisable to leave with his followers, many of whom were Jews. Not all of them were Jews. And that's the historical basis for the story that you see portrayed by Charlton Heston rather dramatically every Easter, I guess, they play it on TV. You have to understand that the book of Exodus and the Bible generally is not a history book. It was never intended to be a history book. The writers of the Old Testament were not presumptuous enough to consider themselves historians. There were no historians in those days. Organized history as we know it only dates back maybe 2,000 years, a little more than 2,000 years. The Bible is much older than that. What they were doing is they were writing a poetic propaganda piece from the point of view of the Hebrew people. And this was done as a common thing by ancient peoples everywhere. It's a sort of a prose poem. This doesn't mean that the Bible or the Old Testament or the book of Exodus is worthless in any way. It's very valuable. It's invaluable. It's very beautiful. It's a magnificent poem that encapsulates fabulous truths and a lot of historical references that check out. But it is not a history book. It's a propaganda piece nonetheless. A beautiful one, but a propaganda piece is what it was designed as and what it remains.
And I just think, you know, that I think a lot of people, you know, all right, let's just back up. It just, to me, is just kind of hard for me to wrap my mind around the idea that, you know, Moses, good old Charlton Heston, was in there stealing stealing tablets from a pyramid. It's like, uh-oh, got caught, better get out of Dodge, and just took off.
That's what happened. This figure that I'm telling you about, his name is Ramosa. He was originally a foreigner himself. He wasn't Egyptian. The Egyptians think he might have been Syrian or he might have been Hebrew. They're not sure themselves. And he took on this. His real name was Beja. It gets really complicated. His real name was Beja, and he changed his name when he became an Egyptian citizen to Ramosa, which means the son of Ra, or the son of the light god. And he rose very high through the ranks. And this is all documented by a brilliant Jewish historian whose work, his name is Demur. And his work has been, when it first came out about 10 years ago, everybody was shocked and amazed that he could say that Moses was this traitor and a thief who absconded with the treasures of Egypt. But now his work has been generally accepted by most, or if not most scholars, many scholars are saying, well, it seems to be that this is the case. He's done his homework very diligently. And that's what I try to base the book on, is not on theories or what people would like to know or like to hear necessarily, but what's the truth? That's the only reason I wrote this book, was because I wanted to find out the truth about this object. And I don't care where the bodies lie afterwards. I just want to find out what really happened. And yeah, the old Charlton Heston figure, he was a little bit rougher than that, it appears. Wasn't quite as divine. He was a human being who took advantage of a military upheaval to become the ruler, the king of the Delta. And when that didn't work out, he had to leave because Pharaoh Merenptah would have been, a little displeased if he'd found out what had happened. Of course, he did find out. And he couldn't follow Ramosa and his followers, or Moses, because his country is being still invaded from four different directions at the same time. So he's too busy fighting off all these Libyans, and he's fighting off the Palestinians, he's fighting off the Nubians, he's finally knocked off the sea people, but then the sea people make this big U-turn out at sea, and they come and invade again. So he's too busy to follow Moses and all of his people. And by the time they abscond with the crystal, the stone of destiny, which is now theirs, they're long gone. And so they're long, far beyond the Egyptian territory. Then Pharaoh eventually dies of old age. The Egyptians had their hands full. I don't think the Egyptians really cared about Ramosa that much. They regarded him as renegades. As a matter of fact, as interestingly enough, is that when Pharaoh Merenptah found out that Moses and his people had stolen the stone of destiny and had done all these deprivations, he didn't send the army out after him. He sent the police out after him, which is what you do. If he probably referred to them as, and he does refer to them as like robbers and thieves rather than, he didn't have any troops to spare for this, so he would just send out the cops. He called out the cops on them. That's all.
The posse. Send out the posse.
Yes, and, call the cops. You know, these people are lawbreakers. They're not real invaders, like the sea people. These are just criminals. And so he sent out the cops, and the cops couldn't catch them.
I just think that idea is just a lot for I think some people have wrapped their mind around that.
That's even
a possibility, much less truth. You know,
well,
let's start with possibility.
Well, that's the whole idea about new ideas, isn't it? You know, you got to sort throw out your old stuff and say, is this true? I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm totally misinterpreted this stuff. Okay, well, then let's consider it. But if people just say, oh, it's too shocking to consider, well, I think it needs to be considered. That's the whole idea about changing one's mind. It's not always an easy or pleasant thing to do, but, I mean, you're going to either cling to fantasy or find out what really happened. And what really happened is that Moses was a traitor and a thief. And he ran away with the treasure, the greatest treasure the Egyptians had, which was this crystal, and used it for his own. And the crystal, he was a high priest, you have to figure. So he knew what was in that thing. It's not like he was not like some common politician. He was a high priest of Heliopolis, for gosh sakes. So he knew what was in the Great Pyramid, and he knew what he would do with that stone. Because if you're out there in the middle of the wilderness, and here you've got a people who have no military background, but when the Jews had been in Egypt for about 300 years, what they had become, they were mostly merchants, they were herders, pastoralists, they had no military background whatsoever. Now they're thrust out into the wilderness, and they're confronted by people who have strong military heritage, like the Philistines. How are you going to beat these people? How are you going to survive against them? You're also terribly outnumbered. Well, you've got a weapon of mass destruction now. This great crystal can be used as any great capacitor in a military function, and that's the only reason how this non-military people were able to blast their way across the Near East and conquer Jerusalem, a military impossibility, unless they had a wonder weapon, and they sure did. That was that crystal that they filched out of the Great Pyramid, and they used it instead as a sonic cannon. Now, I know this is all really difficult for people to accept, especially we're just talking about it in a little space of time here, but I think the evidence seems to indicate that that's just what they did.
And so that would account for the walls of Jericho falling and some of the different things that happened, you know, after they left Egypt and were in Israel and Jerusalem and working on taking over that land and, you know, carrying the ark before them to, you know, foil their foes and win the battles and stuff like that. What you're saying is what happened.
Well, you put your finger right on it, and I think that anybody that listens to what we're talking about here and then goes back and reads the book of Exodus, that section where the Israelites come up against their first military challenge, and that is this great fortress that stands in their way. It's more than a fortress, it's a fortified city. It's called Jericho. It's run by their enemies. And what they do, this battle is described in tremendous detail. It's fabulous. There's never been a confrontation like this before or since. What does the Israelite general do? His name is Joshua. He lines up all of his people, we're told, and he lines up a military band, trumpeters. And what does he do? He takes the Ark of the Covenant, he puts it, they're carrying it with them, and they put it centerpiece with all these people lined up. And they're facing the walls of Jericho. And Joshua tells his people, don't make a noise, don't say anything until I tell you. And when I tell you, you are to make as much noise as you can, yell and shout, and you band members, trumpeters, you blow all of your horns and bang your drums and everything, point everything right at the Ark of the Covenant. And so this happens, this takes place, it's okay, go to it, and they all start yelling, and the trumpeters blow away, and they're all yelling at the Ark of the Covenant, and they're blowing their horns at it. Nothing happens. And so the guys that are their enemies on top of the walls at Jericho, they figure, these people are nuts, but they're very entertaining. We have nothing to worry about. So then Joshua says, okay, no problem. Everybody be quiet again. And he instructs the Ark of the Covenant to be moved just a little bit, just a few feet in some direction. And then he says, okay, now go to it again. Everybody starts yelling. The band starts playing. And what happens? The walls of Jericho come tumbling down. What he was doing is he was range finding, like a piece of artillery. Now, Jericho was found by an archaeologist. Her name was Kenyon, a British archaeologist. She found it in the 1980s, and it was verified by her colleagues. Yes, this is Jericho, to the right time and everything. And when she found Jericho, she found something kind of interesting. Not only had the walls fallen down, they had been pulverized. So she figured, must have been an earthquake in this area, right? So she went to her geological geologist colleagues, and they said, no, there hasn't been any major earthquake in that area for at least 10 or 15,000 years. It's not an earthquake-prone area. So what I believe happened, and what I feel absolutely confident what happened, is that the stone that was inside the Ark of the Covenant, and the Ark of the Covenant is just that, the name means the box, really, the box that the stone came in, that they used it as a sonic cannon, and that General Joshua was getting a fix on the base of the stone wall. So when they're yelling and screaming and the trumpets are blowing, all of that sonic energy, which is just mechanical sound waves, are being picked up and accumulated by this capacitor and then being directed outward in a focused manner to the walls and destroyed, pulverized those walls. And they used the Ark of the Covenant from that battle on, from that victory on, to wipe out their enemies. Their enemies couldn't stand a chance because they had
still fear in all of them.
Oh, the Philistines were horrified. They brought, I mean, the Philistines, how would you feel? You've got this, let's say we were in Iraq with all our great power, and all of a sudden Al-Qaeda had this wonder weapon that was wiping us out, and we couldn't do anything about it. It would be a pretty shocking affair.
Well, didn't the Philistines actually capture the Ark of the Covenant, and then after a while they're like, you know, thanks, but no thanks, and brought it back?
That's fabulous. Now, this sonic cannon, it's not designed to do this. It can do it. It can take sound waves and transform them into mechanical waves and tear down walls and kill people. It's not designed to do that. It's designed to ameliorate the tectonic forces and harness them to electrical forces. So it's being abused. And as the Israelites are dragging this Ark of the Covenant around, it's the same thing as I mentioned before. It's like you're walking across a carpet and then you happen to touch a bronze doorknob and you get an electrical shock or you come in contact with anything that creates polarity. Well, they were doing the same thing. As they're dragging this thing around, it's accumulating energy, building it up, and then randomly shooting it out. They can't control this thing anymore. And then sometimes it degausses itself. What that means is if you degauss something, you take all the electrical energy out of it. In other words, it's shot its wad, as it were, and it's waiting for more time for it to build up other electrical energies. And when
so
that
kind
happens,
of like a flash on a camera, you know, an
yeah.
external flash where it has to kind of cycle through so that you can take another flash shot.
Absolutely. And after it's had that flash, it's blown all its energy for a while, and it's got to recycle. So they used it so much that sometimes the damn thing didn't work. They bring it out into battle, and the thing would just sit there. And in one such battle, they lost it mightily, and the worst thing, the Ark of the Covenant was actually captured by their enemies, the Philistines. So the Philistines just thought, now we've got them. We'll figure out how this thing works, and we'll wipe them out. Well, as it turns out, the Philistines had no greater luck with it than the Israelites had, and they're dragging it around. And what happens is it starts making them sick. They start building up all of these cancerous tumors, and they bring it from one Philistine city to another, and it's always the same. They're getting ill. Now, this fits in so perfectly with something we know today as ultrasound. Ultrasound is the same thing. It's the application of mechanical waves in sound to work on people's muscles. But if you keep an ultrasound device too long on somebody, what does it do? It creates a tumor. It creates a bruise that can turn into a tumor. Well, the Philistines had no idea how this thing worked, and it's developing all of this static electricity and randomly discharging it and making them sick. So the Philistines, what a story. The Philistines then say, we're going to have to give it back to the Jews. We want them all wiped out, but we just have to give them this thing back. So they put it on a cart, an ox cart. And this is all described in great detail in the book of Exodus. And they get this ox cart going out of Philistine territory, and they bring it across the border where the Israelites are. And the Israelites see this ox cart coming along, and wow, we've got our wonder weapon back.
Cool. Well, we need to go take another break. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. We're talking to Frank Joseph, author of Opening the Ark of the Covenant, and we'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Thank you. Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
The International Association of Medical Intuitives is an organization dedicated to connecting you with professional medical intuitives from around the world. So if you're feeling ill and under the weather, or are looking to join a professional organization such as this, visit www.medicalintuitives.net. That's www.medical-intuitives.net.
Move past the crossroads in your life and discover alternative solutions to your deepest concerns at soulhealer.com. So whether it's a physical problem, an emotional issue, a question about work, or troubles in your relationships, naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise can help you. Bring peace, harmony, and health back into your life. Schedule a session today. Visit soulhealer.com right away and live the life you've been dreaming of.
Are you involved in a new relationship that seems too good to be true? You know, there is an easy way to find out who you're dealing with. For over a decade, AmericaFind has provided its customers with information to make faster, safer, and smarter relationship decisions. Their background check service is a quick and inexpensive way to feel more secure about all your personal and professional relationships. AmericaFind will empower you with all the resources you need to check an individual's background and credibility. So before you say, I do, or hire a new babysitter or nanny, call AmericaFind. Know what you're getting into before you invest your heart, your money, or your time. Call us toll-free at 888-256-2155, and in less than 30 minutes, we'll give you peace of mind. Let AmericaFind tell you the truth.
You can get a copy of Dr. Rita's latest book, Avoiding the Cosmic 2x4, by visiting www.soulhealer.com. Get your copy today. Hi, I'm Dr. Rita Louise, the host of Just Energy Radio and the founder of the Institute of Applied Energetics. Start a new career today on the leading edge of alternative health and healing. The Institute of Applied Energetics can help you develop the specialized skills you need to work as an energy medicine practitioner, intuitive counselor, or professional medical intuitive. Besides our outstanding technical instruction, our programs also support you in creating and building a successful business in this rapidly growing field. Be a catalyst for changing the way healthcare is done around the world. Contact the Institute of Applied Energetics right away or visit AppliedEnergeticsInstitute.com.
And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hi, I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and we had a little mute problem, but I'm back. Frank,
I'm still here.
We had the Ark in Israel, and then all of a sudden it kind of drops out of the Bible. And when the Babylonians came and conquered Israel and basically took everything that they had, there wasn't, you know, the Ark of the Covenant, which you would think was their most prized possession and most valuable possession, was gone. So if the Babylonians didn't get it, what happened to it?
Well, in the year 587 B.C., the Babylonians sacked Jerusalem. And for about 400 years before, this Ark of the Covenant that we've been talking about, such an unhappy device, had been enshrined in Solomon's Temple, the first temple. That is the reason why the temple was made, to enshrine the Ark of the Covenant in the Holy of Holies. It was known as the Debir in Hebrew. And there, it was in its proper setting. It was on top of a seismically active mountain, Mount Moriah, later known as the Temple Mount. And the Ark of the Covenant was no longer involved in causing tumors and killing people and so on. It performed the way it was supposed to do, not only to ameliorate, I must mention this, this is important to include here, that the Ark of the Covenant had two primary functions. The first one was mundane, and the other one was sacred. The mundane one was to ameliorate the worst effects of earthquakes. That's what it was designed for, to make society possible in areas that were seismically unstable. Beyond that, however, is that when the Ark was, or the stone, was activated properly, it produced huge amounts of negative ions, which interfaced with what medical practitioners refer to today as the God part of the brain, the hippocampus. When the hippocampus is properly stimulated by negative ions, human beings experience the presence of God. They have visions. They have all kinds of psychic phenomena taking place around them, out-of-body experiences, which become very real to them. It's used in hospitals today to sedate people who are otherwise allergic and get bad reactions to ordinary anesthesia. So that's what the Ark, that's why the Ark is so valuable and such a wonderful thing. It not only is part of a fabulous industrial technology, which we haven't invented yet, which can take care of earthquakes, but also can stimulate the hippocampus and put us in touch with God. It's like almost a telephone to the divine. And that's why the Ark is such a valuable thing, and that's why it's been sought for thousands of years by many people around the world. And
if that was one of the things that the Ark did, I don't get the impression that the Israelites, you know, once as they went through the Sinai Desert for 40 years, couldn't they ask the, you know, the crystal for directions or something? I mean, I don't know. I just feel like if it was providing enlightenment, as a society, they didn't seem all that enlightened. I mean, no offense, you know, to those people, but...
Well, the reason why is because it had been removed, remember, from its proper context in the Great Pyramid. In the Great Pyramid, it functioned the way it was supposed to, as a transducer and as the spiritual device. However, when they're dragging it around the so-called Promised Land, it is no longer in its sacred mode, and it's being used as a weapon. It's being used as a military function, which it was not designed to do, although it could perform as a military device, as a weapon. But the Israelites knew enough about it that eventually when they did enshrine it properly, it would work the way that they had intended. And they used it as a weapon to blast their way through to Jerusalem, which they felt that that was the place that was part of their deep old heritage, ancient even then, as the place that really belonged to them. So you would think it would make them an enlightened people, but actually it wouldn't, because it was used just as for military purposes. And after it was enshrined properly by Solomon, I mean, this thing has, it's like a mind boost, because like Solomon is known as the wise, Solomon the wise, and people that are in, the reason why he was wise is because he was being irradiated by this stone, the Ark of the Covenant, when it was in its proper context. Whenever it is enshrined properly, it always results in a golden age for whoever possesses it. The age of Solomon is regarded as Israel's golden age, and that's when the Ark was functioning properly, just as the golden age of Egypt was the Old Kingdom, when the Benben stone, or the Stone of Destiny, was enshrined in the Great Pyramid. And wherever it goes, it creates, if it's handled properly, it creates a golden age for those that handle it.
But, so when it left Israel, or if it's still in Israel, what happened to it, or where do you think it is now?
In 587 B.C., the Babylonians razed Jerusalem to the ground. And they did that, and they tore down every stone looking for the Ark of the Covenant. They didn't find it. The Babylonians' bureaucratic records survive to this day, and we have a complete tally of everything, every stick that they took out of Jerusalem. And among them is not the Ark of the Covenant. The reason why is because Israeli archaeologists have found exactly what happened to it. The engineers who created the Solomon's Temple created a 150-foot deep shaft through the solid limestone rock that's on top of Mount Moriah. And it was through this shaft that they created something like a dumb waiter in in which the arc would literally be opened up into a doorway that would lead into the shaft and then just reeled down and then sealed. And the Babylonians were completely unable to find this because they were nowhere near to being such great engineers. Matter of fact, nobody possessed the engineering skill that was necessary to put the ark in its position, 150 feet below Mount Moriah, until many, many centuries later when another group of people who were very skilled in engineering came along to Temple Mount specifically to find that object. And they are known as the Knights Templars. And for almost 10 years, only nine of them, there were only nine at this time, labored extensively all over the Temple Mount. This is just after the Crusades had taken over the Holy Land. And they labored at the top of Mount Moriah for almost 10 years until they finally found the Ark. The shaft that was used by the Templars has been found and verified. Templar artifacts dating to this period, we're talking about 1127 AD now. In 1127 AD, which we feel is probably in midsummer 1127 AD, the Knights Templars finally found through their honeycombing efforts the Ark of the Covenant at the base of its 150-foot deep shaft. It was removed in fall of that year under terms of great secrecy because the Templars were dedicated to keeping this object out of the hands of all politicians and all religious officials. The Pope at this time was nothing more than a mafia don, and the kings, the politicians who ran Europe at that time, were what we would describe today as murderous psychopaths. The Knights Templars were determined that these people would never have anything what to do with the Ark, and so they were able to spirit the Ark out of Jerusalem in the fall of 1127 A.D., and their first landfall was at Brindisi in Italy. It was then removed, and this is in the southeast of Italy. Then it was removed to northern Italy, a monastery called the Sorborga Monastery. Sorborga Monastery still exists. It's close to the Italian Alps, and it was run by a very famous man in his day, and even more famous today, Bernard de Clairvaux. It's now known as Saint Bernard. Saint Bernard was one of the founders of the Knights Templars. Knights Templars was actually founded by three men, and he was one of the most important founders. It was then removed in the winter of 1127, or 1128 AD, removed from the Sorborga Monastery and brought to St. Bernard's chief monastery in Troyes, France. This is called the Citeaux Monastery, the Monastery of Citeaux. And there it was kept for a few years under great secrecy while its permanent home was being built. And this permanent home was Chartres Cathedral. If you go to Chartres Cathedral today, over its north portal, which was the main entrance, originally intended as the main entrance for Chartres Cathedral, it is inscribed in Latin, "The Ark is here." And above the Latin proclamation, there is a depiction, a sculpted frieze depiction of the Ark of the Covenant on the ox cart that I told you about. There are several direct, clear references to the Ark of the Covenant being in Chartres Cathedral that were incorporated in the actual architecture of the building.
Isn't that kind of obvious for trying to hide something? You know, a big arrow pointing like, here, look over here for this secret mystery thing?
The idea was at a certain time was not to hide it, but to enshrine it. They were hiding They were hiding it only until the proper time when they felt that they could enshrine it in Chartres Cathedral, without it being jeopardized by political or religious authorities. However, those authorities got wind of the object and were bent on obtaining it. The Templars decided that they were not going to use the cathedral because, as you say, it would have been easily obtained. So what they did is they created a subgroup, an elite within an elite. And this subgroup within the Templars were to be given charge of the Ark of the Covenant. It was their duty to make sure that it does not fall into the wrong hands, and they're to protect it. That's their only chief goal. And these people were called the Cathars, or the Purers. It comes from the word, the Greek word catharsis. You have a catharsis when you have a great religious experience, like an epiphany or something, your soul is supercharged and changed. And that's because these people, these Cathars, men and women, they practiced on a level of equality which was unheard of during the Dark Ages. They were in charge of the Ark and were being constantly irradiated by it. Their God part of their brain, their hippocampus, was blown wide open. And they lit upon a plan for preserving the Ark. Instead of putting it in a fortress or a big cathedral, they created, through the Templars, who were very wealthy, a network of castles all across France. They owned these castles, and they would move it from one castle to another until a time in the future when they could keep it public, open to public. But in their time, they knew they couldn't do it. So they moved it around from one. Montreal de Sauce was the very first castle where they kept it for a short time. When the Pope found out about it, he'd go after it. This frustrated the attempts of both the French king and the Italian Pope from getting the Ark. And so the Pope finally decided, his name was Pope Innocent, interestingly enough. Pope Innocent III said, that's it. We're not going to go castle hopping around. We're going to grab that thing. And what he did is he came up with atrocity propaganda against the Cathars, told all of his fellow Christians across Western and Eastern Europe that the Cathars were the devil incarnate, worshipped the devil, they were Satanists, and he launched something called the Albigensian Crusade. He wouldn't even refer to them as Cathars. He thought that was despicable. They weren't pure at all. Some of them had come from a town called Albi, and so he said, well, they're all Albigensians. That's the Pope's name. And he launched a crusade against fellow Europeans in which a minimum of 2 million people died. It was a horrendous atrocity. And he was able to get people hysterical, worked up. They didn't know the authority of the Pope. They had no idea what was really going on. They were duped by this atrocity propaganda. And the forces of French Catholicism eventually, after 40 years, this went on 40 years at the cost of millions of people, tremendous devastation all across Western Europe. This is where the Dark Ages really hit rock bottom.
So we only have like a couple of minutes left in this segment, and okay. I wanted to ask a question. If they were moving the Ark around as much and it was collecting energy, you know, I would assume that in the moving it would be collecting energy. And is there any documentation of it discharging or blowing something up or something happening as it was traveling around?
There is wonderful evidence to show that it was being activated properly. That's because the Cathars were professionals in this. They were brilliant intellectuals and aristocrats who were not using it as a weapon, but were using it strictly as a spiritual device. It appears that they knew exactly what they were doing. Yes, that there are many indications that it was that it would glow or that it would produce a kind of electrical aura. But this is because they were working it properly.
And they weren't trying to... Okay, that makes sense. Okay, well, we need to go to break again. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. This is Just Energy Radio. We're talking to Frank Joseph, author of Opening the Ark of the Covenant. But we'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages. Hi, I'm James Athayanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio. Listen to Dr. Rita's Soul Healer Moment live each third Sunday night of the month on Feet to the Fire. www.feet2fire.com for more information.
Are you in the middle of a messy divorce? Do you think your spouse is trying to hide money, possessions, or property from you? Call America Fine today. AmericaFind will give you an accurate picture of your spouse's assets. We can help you locate any hidden bank accounts, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, or safety deposit boxes that have been concealed from you in the courts. The reality is, the court can only divide what it knows exists. Be smart and take control of your future. Make sure everything is put on the table before you step into the courtroom. Just call us today, toll free at 888-256-2155. And in less than 24 hours, we'll give you peace of mind. Let AmericaFind help you get the fair judgment you deserve.
You want to host your own radio talk show? You provide the voice and the content. We do all the rest. www.innerstreamsradio.com for more information.
Hi, I'm Dr. Rita Louise, the host of Just Energy Radio. There's no greater blessing in the world than your good health. Science is now showing that simply eating a high-quality diet doesn't provide us with all the nutrition we need. Doctors recommend we supplement our diets with products derived from whole food concentrates. And one of the most complete and nutritious whole foods found on the earth are little microscopic plants called marine phytoplankton, which can be found in a product called Frequency. I've been taking Frequency every day for about 6 months now, and I feel more energized and full of life. If you're ready to make a difference in your health, I encourage you to try Frequency and see what it can do for you. To learn more about Frequency and other amazing whole food natural products direct from Mother Nature, please visit productsforthesoul.com.
Start the year off right by visiting livinggrocery.com. Experience the miracle of real nutrition as it helps you to lose weight and improve your overall health. Don't mess with pills or capsules. We provide the highest quality, all-natural, organic foods that come ready to eat. And best of all, it's delivered straight to your door. Visit livinggrocery.com now and experience your own amazing transformation.
Are you feeling stuck and unsure which way to turn on your path? Do you lack focus and direction in life? Do you feel something is missing? So what do you want? A better job? Your dream home? More money? Your ideal mate? Dakara has practical tools to assist you. Schedule a session today to get clear about what you truly desire to deliberately create the life you want. For more information, visit ManifestingConsultant.com or call toll-free 1-800-813-3877.
And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Dr. Rita Louise, and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. We're talking to Frank Joseph, the author of Opening the Ark of the Covenant. Frank, we're like in our last segment, and I just feel like we've just barely brushed the surface of your incredible research. And we're getting very close to current time. And so, okay, it was in France. Then what happened to it?
Well, where
do you think
much
it is
time,
today? Where do you think it is today? I guess that's the better question.
Okay. I was able to, my co-author and my wife, Laura Baldwin, and I were able to really tie down the story of the Ark pretty clearly all the way up to its disappearance in 1244 A.D., up to March 19th of 1244 A.D.,
Well, that's pretty specific.
Because that is the time that the Cathars were finally exterminated. Because it was on that day, in 1244, that the Cathars, the last 205 of them, were burned at the stake. And the what they referred to then as the Mani Stone, or the Holy Grail, the same thing, disappeared. And there are about 15 or so different locations where the Ark might be. And the most provocative of them all, and the one that makes a tremendous amount of sense and is very well documented, is that it was taken, first of all, in the 18th century, sometime around 1750, to Canada, to a place called New France. And the capital of New France at that time was Montreal. Most people don't realize that Montreal was built by a group of French religious fanatics who were intent on making the New Jerusalem and had in fact recreated Solomon's Temple, or a smaller version of Solomon's Temple, in Montreal, and that this building still exists in part, and that as part of the recreation of Solomon's Temple in the New Jerusalem at Montreal, Canada, the Ark of the Covenant perhaps was brought and placed in this recreation for a short time. The society that created it fell apart. That part of the world was a conflict zone between the French and the British at that time, and a priest by the name of Father Jean Baudouin, who is a direct ancestor of the lady that wrote the book with me, interestingly enough, Father Jean Baudouin, took the Ark of the Covenant, and with his friend LaSalle, very famous name in the early history of American exploration, took the Ark of the Covenant, and on board their ship, which was called Le Griffin, sailed the Great Lakes looking for a place where they could dispose of the Ark of the Covenant. He could not return to Europe, which was a scene of despotism at that time. And we're cutting to the chase here. I know we don't have much time. So I can tell you that it looks as though either the Ark or a recreation of the Ark or another version of the Ark, something like that, was brought by Father Jean Baudouin to Illinois. First of all, to Peoria, Illinois. It was known as Crèvecœur, Illinois at that time. It's now known as Peoria. And when he was in Peoria, he was informed by local Indians known as Yuchi, the Yuchi tribe Indians, of a cave. And it was in this cave that Father Baudouin set out with his Yuchi Indian guides, and it is in this cave that the Ark of the Covenant may have been placed. And there are some strong indications that something like the Ark is today in that cave. There was an underground photograph made through sonar, ground penetration radar is referred to actually as, which took an image of an object inside a small chamber under this cave, which is being explored as we speak, literally as we speak, being excavated. And this one chamber, which has been sealed off, contains an object that appears to look like the general description of the Ark of the Covenant, a rectangular box with two poles sticking out on either side. So that's a possibility.
That's what you think. So let me ask one question. One of the things you talked about was the possibility, or that there are more than one of these crystals. And you've also alluded to that there's potentially more than one Ark.
Yeah.
And so would there be a different set of crystals in these different Arks?
I think they'd be fundamentally the same. It's the same technology being used. I think that these stones or the Arks were used for the same thing, which was, first of all, to ameliorate worst effects of earthquakes, but most importantly, to be supercharged by the spiritual energies which can be generated by this object, which can interface with the hippocampus and the human brain. I think that if we were today in close proximity to this object, we would have a sense of reality of our spiritual dimension. We know about spirituality by reading and by experiences and so forth, but this would be something far beyond anything we have ever experienced before. We'd actually experience the reality of God, as it were. And I think that would really transform our lives more than any single experience we might have. And that's what.
Maybe we all need to move to Illinois.
Well, we're not just yet. They have to find it first, if that really is what we're thinking about.
So do you have any new projects coming up, new books on the forefront that you're working on?
Well, what I'm working on right now is just what I'm doing tonight. I'm spreading the gospel, as it were, about the Ark of the Covenant. So this is my main focus. I think it's the most important thing I've ever done. It's taken me 26 years to write this book and to put everything that I've put together. I travel around the world just to find out about this object and to nail it down as best I can. So I'd like to get feedback from people after they've read the book and see what they think, point out all of its mistakes, especially its errors, and also to confirm its strong points. But the main thing right now is that I really like doing just what I'm doing with you, is discussing this, and your wonderfully and insightful questions are just what I'm looking for.
Well, you know, anybody that is looking for a book that is very well researched, I mean, it's hard to believe the amount of research that it just exudes. And actually, I was reading and I'm going, you know, you condense so much information into, you know, I don't know how many pages it is, you know, and I was, you know, I just am like not talking good tonight. And I felt like it could have been like two or three volumes. Oops. Well, there's music. Frank, very quick, if someone wants a copy, where can they get it?
Well, they can go to www.amazon.com and they can get copies there. Or it's also in Barnes & Noble and Borders stores. If the copy's not in that store, go to customer service and they can order it for you in a day.
Great. Thank you so much for coming on, Frank.
Thank you for the opportunity. It was really a lot of fun.
Great. Next week, we're going to have Michelle Avanti talking about what are your dreams trying to tell you. And also, we're having a special live broadcast from the 2007 Roswell UFO Festival with our special guest and co-host, Jerry Pippin from jerrypippin.com. So please join us next week for Just Energy Radio. And till then, be blessed.
Join host Dr. Rita Louise each week at this time for Just Energy Radio. Point your browser to www.justenergyradio.com for more show information and to contact Dr. Rita. Until next time, remember, it's all just energy. 70 million Americans suffer from sleep deficit. I'm James Athayanchik.